On the flow path, we are drawn forward by fire, by powerful hedonic instincts, by our deep need for autonomy, mastery, and purpose deeply fulfilled, by dizzyingly feel-good neurochemistry, by a spectrum of joy beyond common ken, by the undeniable presence of our most authentic selves, by a cognitive imperative to make meaning from experience, by the search engine that is evolution and its need for innovation, and by the simplest of truths. Life is long, and we're all scared, and in flow, at least for a little while, we're not. Travis Rice and the Art of Flight. A few years after Deeper, Travis Rice embarked on his own film project, the appropriately named Art of Flight. While Jeremy Jones's goal in Deeper had been the far frontier of snowboarding exploration, in Flight, Rice wanted to showcase the far frontier of athletic performance, the very cutting edge of snowboarding possibility. Of course, Jones joined him for part of the trip. Of course, they went to hunt for spines. A very short history of paradigm shifts in big mountain riding. Early days, lots of turns, just trying to survive the steeps. Next phase, turns are for sissies, straight lining the steeps. Then cliffs get added into the mix. Big cliffs soon follow. Next, athletes started doing park tricks off cliffs, then off big cliffs. And then, for good measure, spines entered the picture. A cirque is a naturally formed concave amphitheater, carved by glaciers, found atop mountains. These steep slopes are dotted with protrusions, huge cliffs, knobby rollovers, bus-sized boulders. Snow piles up on these protrusions, forming near-vertical, knife-edge columns thousands of feet tall. These are spines. And for flow junkies, spines are irresistible. "It's full-body snowboarding," explains Jones. "The snow is so deep you need to use your arms and chest to swim and your legs to ride. They also collapse underfoot, so you're riding mini-avalanches and dodging slough slides. Spines have blind rollovers, so you can't see below or to the side. Every time the midline is crossed, it's a leap into the abyss. Plus, there's no way to stop, and every move is amplified by complicated forces. A tiny hop can easily become a 20-foot ollie. It's the absolute edge of chaos. But the easiest way to live in the moment is to put yourself in a situation where there's no other choice. Spines demand that. They hurl you deep into the zone." Jones and Rice went spine hunting in the Selkirk Mountains outside of Revelstoke, British Columbia. Time schedules being what they were, they only had a few days together, and their first morning turned out to be frustrating. The weather was iffy, the visibility poor. They searched for hours and hours and still nothing to ride. A decision was made to park the helicopter on a mountaintop and regroup. Then a small miracle. No sooner had they landed than a break in the clouds, and off in the distance, a spine wall. They flew to the top of the wall and climbed out. That's when one of the guides glanced across the valley and realized they were standing on the peak exactly opposite from where snowboarding legend Craig Kelly died. This struck everyone as more than a coincidence. "Kelly was the pioneer," explains Rice. "He tore apart the fabric of how things were done in snowboarding. He was the first guy to prove you could make a living riding in the backcountry. He did all these absolutely incredible things and then decided to become a Canadian certified mountain guide, which is the highest level of certification and the hardest to get in the world. For decades, it's been a skiers only club, but Craig was trying to become the first guide certified on a snowboard. He died on an avalanche certification trip. Fast forward 8 years, and we're standing on this giant face directly across where he died. It was powerful." And there's an important truth hidden in that power. Action and adventure athletes have found a way to turn the worst thing that can happen on the flow path into another reason to move forward. Frank Gambale died, and Shane McConkie and Miles Dasher honored his memory by diving deeper into skydiving. Shane McConkie died, and Jeremy Jones carried his ashes into the uncharted unknown. There's long tradition here. The tradition of honoring someone who has died trying to live their life to the fullest by, in turn, living your own life to the fullest. Of course, there's a little more to the tradition than this. For starters, as Rice points out, every death brings a lesson. Action and adventure athletes lead different kinds of lives. There aren't exactly playbooks. So the best athletes try really hard to learn from each other's mistakes, especially the fatal ones. I just lost a friend in Japan. The party got him. That was one kind of wake-up call. Craig's death was another. There, the lesson was even more complicated. The people he was with had the very best knowledge of snow science in the world, but he still died. So, sometimes, the more you know, the less you know. Sometimes, not knowing makes you more hesitant, and that can help keep you alive. Equally important is the metaphysical. I've had incredibly profound experiences doing what I do, explains Rice, and I'm a very different person because of it. I didn't come from a religious background. Growing up, everything was proof-driven. If you couldn't see it, couldn't experience it, it didn't exist. But I've had experiences that bitch-slapped me out of this lower-order mentality. My need for proof, I've been given it. Now, if you want to tell me that God doesn't exist, well, now you have to prove that to me. And by proof, Rice is talking about the experience of oneness that arrives in deep flow. At the root of all fear is separation, he says. That's especially true for mortal fears. But in flow, that's gone completely. It's the most comforting truth that there's no separation, no death. So when you talk about the tradition of honoring fallen comrades by pushing harder, we'll most of us have had these spiritual experiences, so part of that tradition involves this other invisible legacy, this shared exploration of the mystery. So what does this all mean? It means that beyond pushing on physical limits, these athletes are also pushing on more nebulous boundaries. It means that at the center of the action and adventure brotherhood, there's a bit of a mystery cult. It means, as it always has, that if you want to probe the mystery, sacrifice is required. In simpler terms, these athletes have taken the radical step of turning mortality into motivation and have fundamentally rearranged their lives and their values to accommodate this change. In the last chapter, we saw hints of this shift with athletes willing to bet their asses on an idea. Here, in perhaps the surest sign of a culture of innovation, we're seeing a social extension of this same principle. When innovation leads to death, powerful tradition ensures that death leads to more innovation. Is there a lesson here for the rest of us? Of course. There's no way to avoid the dark side of flow. Athletes hit walls. Writers run into writer's block. Executives overcommit and burn out. And the key that Rice and others have found is to embrace that suffering, to move through it, and to keep moving. This means learning to use the bad to fuel the good, the way Dean Potter leveraged the pain of Flo's absence to drive himself closer to his most authentic self is a small example. The way the entire action and adventure community honors the dead with the death-defying, a larger one. And this is exactly what happened that day in British Columbia. Travis Rice and Jeremy Jones rode in tribute to Craig Kelly's memory. It was quite a tribute. First, Jones nailed one of the better spine rides of his career. Then Rice changed the game. The spine that Rice picked out included everything that Jones's choice featured: blind rollovers, tight chutes, huge slough, crazy exposure, and big drops. But it also included some acrobatics. Two-thirds of the way down, doing 50-mile-per-hour hop turns down the pointy edge of ridiculous, Rice launched off a 60-foot cliff, spun a perfect backside 180, then landed atop another spine. It was straight out of a video game. Our first glimpse of the next frontier. Watching from the bottom of the run, Jones just shook his head. "You've got to be kidding me," he said. "That is the future, and the future is now." 11. The flow of next. Future flow. In the last chapter, we took a hard look at the difficulties involved in pursuing the flow path. In this one, our interest is in examining the inverse, the reasons to persevere. And the very best reason? No surprise. It's what happens when we do. For most people, flow hacking is an esoteric pursuit. But these days, in action and adventure sports, it's become standard operating procedure. In this world, learning how to access the zone is treated like learning to read or ride a bike. It's information so fundamental, it's being passed down between generations. So taking a closer look at the next generation of action and adventure athletes gives us a look at what might actually be possible for all of us if we can make flow central to culture. This next generation of athletes makes for an unusual case study. The extremists who came before them, the Shane McConkie, Danny Way, Laird Hamilton generation, who inform the majority of this book, all started out as part of a marginalized subculture with little societal support and almost no knowledge of flow. Every pinnacle they climbed the hard way. The athletes we're about to meet have had an almost opposite experience. They're the only generation in history to have been raised in a flow-hacking tradition, a high-flow environment, and a culture where using flow to push past impossible is par for the course. They are, to borrow the Silicon Valley term, fast followers. And by examining how fast and how far these followers have come, we can better gauge what just might be possible for ourselves and our children. Even better, we are now at the front edge of a high-tech, high-performance revolution. While the athletes of the last generation had to make up their training regimens as they went along, today's practitioners are benefiting from an inrush of techniques and technologies that make accessing flow and using the state to accelerate progression far easier than ever before. Right now, these tools are mainly available to elite performers, like the next generation athletes described in this chapter. But this, too, is starting to change. Thus, taking a look at these tools, seeing both where they're at today and where they'll be tomorrow, gives us another barometer for our own future potential and yet another reason to persevere. Tom Schar and the Children of the Revolution. If there was a moment in time when the accelerated progression in action and adventure sports first pierced public consciousness, it was June 27th, 1999. The X Games were in San Francisco. More than 275,000 people in attendance and another 55 million watching on TV. This was also the first full professional sporting event broadcast live on the Internet. So between traditional audiences, net viewers, and those who watched web videos after the fact, a figure arguably over 100 million, this moment marked a historic anomaly, one of the few times that so many got to see impossible become possible. The impossible in question took place during the final round of skateboarding's best trick competition. Tony Hawk was squaring off against Bob Burnquist, Bucky Lasik, Colin McKay, and Andy McDonald. On his first run, Hawk landed a varial 720, meaning he rode up the ramp backward, launched into the air, spun around twice, then flipped his board 180 degrees, landing forward with his board now facing backward. It was a hell of a trick. Perhaps not enough to win. Everyone was throwing down hard that night. But all Hawk had prepared. The fact that he nailed it on his first run left him 15 minutes of contest time to try whatever the hell he wanted. And what he wanted was the 900. The 900 was the great impossible of skate. 2.5 rotations. It required massive amplitude and dizzying commitment. The landings mostly blind. The falls terrifying. Hawk had then been chasing the trick for 13 painful years. Never had he pulled one off. Nor had anyone else. Though Danny Way came exceptionally close in 1989. And honestly, at the X Games, Hawk didn't think he was going to break that losing streak, but with the crowd all amped up, his original intention was to just put on a show. It was a show, all right. Hawk missed on his first attempt, but something was different. The spins felt more solid than ever before, and he made a decision. Either he nailed the trick or ended the night in the hospital. Everything blanked out except the nine. Hawk later wrote in his autobiography, Occupation, Skateboarder. The announcer's voice occasionally drifted into my head, telling me my time was up, that this was my last try. But there was no way I was about to stop when the nines felt that good. I don't recall walking up the ramp after each attempt. All I thought about was getting a good look in the middle of the spin so I could spot a landing. I'd just drop in, spin, fall, get up, and walk up the ramp over and over again. Everyone else had stopped skating. I remember thinking since the time limit was up, I wasn't going to win the best trick with the nine, but it wasn't about the contest. As the saying goes, the 12th time was the charm. Hawk, finally, nailed the 900. While he didn't exactly stump the landing, he came down in a squat, nearly dragging his back hand on the ramp, he'd pulled it off all the same. The crowd went nuts. The real world as well. Major papers ran headlines featuring Hawk's name. Every skater on the planet heard the news, or, that is, almost every skater. Tom Schaar didn't hear the news. Then again, when Tony landed his nine, Tom wasn't yet born. Schaar was born 3 months later, on September 14th, 1999, a toe-headed kid from Malibu, California. He started skating by the time he was 5 years old. By the time he was nine, he was attempting 540s, 1.5 rotations. This alone is unfathomable. For an entire generation of skaters, the 540 was the dividing line. I remember thinking, explains Rodney Mullins in Bones Brigade, about the first time he saw the trick. That right there, that was neck-breaking material. And once Mike McGill landed that first 540, all other pros faced a hard choice. Either learn the move or quit the game. More than a few retired. Tom Schaar, though, learned the move in under a year, landing his first 540 at just 10 years old. Schaar landed his first 720 at age 10 as well. That was also the year he rode down the mega ramp for the first time. The mega ramp gave him ideas. With all that height, with all that speed, maybe, he thought, he should give the 900 a try. It was a slightly ridiculous notion. Only 6 other people beside Hawk had landed the trick. Schaar was 12 years old when he decided to give it a try. 3 months later, he had the move down. And he was still only 12 years old. This was about the time Schaar started thinking about the 1080, a full 3 rotations, a trick no one else in the world had ever done. He decided to start working on it at Woodward, the California-based action sports camp for kids, and one of only 2 places in the world that houses a publicly accessible mega ramp. Schaar is 5'1 and 94 pounds. Essentially the Kate Moss of skateboarding, only shorter. And the Woodward ramp proved too big for his needs. The gap jump was giving him too much speed, and he was sailing too high out of the quarter pipe for the spins to be controllable. Red Bull stepped in next. They paid for a new section of ramp, turning the gap into a rollover and allowing Schaar to dampen acceleration. That was all it took. In March 2012, and on only his 5th try, Tom Schaar landed the world's first 1080. Afterward, he told reporters, I can't believe I can do something Tony Hawk can't. He was still only 12 years old. Shar's success turned him into a rock star. It also earned him an invitation to the 2012 X Games Asia, where he used the 1080 to beat out 11-time X Games gold medalist Bob Burnquist in the Big Air Finals, becoming, still at 12, the youngest X Games gold medalist in history. He was also invited to compete against the far stiffer competition at the 2012 Summer X Games North America. Making this tale that much stranger, Shar wasn't the only one in his age bracket to receive such an invitation. "There are about 10 of us really young kids doing the contests," he explains. "It's crazy. We get to skate with these people we always looked up to. And they get to beat them, too." At Summer X, Shar himself placed 6th, but 15-year-old Mitchie Brusco, in his second X Games competition, took home Big Air Silver with a 720 jump over the gap and 900 off the quarter pipe. And how did he pull off two of skating's hardest tricks on the biggest stage in the sport? "I try not to think about anything," Brusco said in a post-victory interview. "I just try to let my body do the work. My body knows how to do it better than my brain, so I kind of just let it take over." Which is to say, this new generation of action and adventure athletes are already a generation of flow hackers. Even Shar, at 12, is starting to understand the concepts. "When I'm trying a trick," he says, "I try to block everything else out. I just try to stay calm and focused on what I'm doing." This may not sound like much, but many of the athletes interviewed for this audiobook talk about not starting to experiment with the mental game until later in their career, and usually only after being forced in that direction by injury. It comes down to cultural learning. Danny Way, Laird Hamilton, Dean Potter, Shane McConkie, Mandy Ray Cruikshank, Jeremy Jones, Doug Emmons, these athletes were pioneers, trailblazers into the impossible. Tom Shar and his fellow youngsters are the children of this revolution. Shar was born into a world where the 900 was a done deal. He was 8 years old when Danny Way jumped the Great Wall of China on a mega ramp. As a result, both his baseline for reality and his spectrum for possibility are a quantum leap forward from almost anything anyone born in the 20th century can imagine. This matters. Flow is a creation engine. It helps us pluck an idea out of imagination and bring it fully formed into the world. Tom Shar dreamed up the 1080, then used flow to pull that vision out of his subconscious and into a material existence. There is a deep interrelationship here. Our limits are governed by flow's ability to amplify performance as much as by imagination's ability to dream up that performance. So asking the question, "Where do our limits lie?" is another way of asking, "How far can we stretch our imagination?" Here in the 21st century? Pretty far indeed. The Roger Bannister Effect. No one really knows exactly when the 4-minute mile first seemed possible. Certainly, in 1923, when Finnish runner Paavo Nummi clocked a 4:10.4, it wasn't beyond the pale. Yet 8 years passed before anyone sliced a second from Nummi's time, and it took 10 more for the next three to fall. By 1942, runners had cut it down to 4:04.6, then 4:02.6 by 1943. 2 years later, Swedish miler Gunder Hägg clocked 4:01.4, and impossible seemed within reach. A good tailwind, a better track surface, slicing one tick off the time, it was bound to happen. But nothing happened. Not in 1946, or 1947, or 1948. The issue, turns out, wasn't merely physical. It was mental. Most people considered running 4 laps of the track in 4 minutes to be beyond the limits of human speed, explains Neil Bascom in The Perfect Mile. It was foolhardy and possibly dangerous to attempt. Some thought that rather than a lifetime of glory, honor, and fortune, a hearse would be waiting for the first person to accomplish that feat. It was Englishman Roger Bannister who, 9 years after Haig's near miss, finally broke this mental barrier and accomplished the feat, running 3:59.4 on May 6th, 1954. And when we retell this tale, this is typically the point where the story stops. Yet, 2 months after Bannister did the impossible and lived, Australian John Landy did it again and then some, cutting 1.4 seconds off Bannister's time with 3:58 flat. Within 5 years, two other runners had bested that mark. Within 10, the first sub-4 mile had been run by a high school student. Think about this for a moment. 30 years of collective running effort were required to do the impossible. Yet it took less than a month for someone to better the feat, and less than a decade for 5 more people, including a teenager, to do the same? How did this happen? The physical challenge didn't get any easier. Running a sub-4-minute mile still required running a sub-4-minute mile. All that changed was thought. Assumption. The mental frame built around the challenge. Every athlete interviewed for this book agrees. After something has been done once, it becomes considerably easier to repeat. Yet why is this so? What is it exactly about learning that the impossible is possible that makes it suddenly possible? It's a two-part question. The first part concerns the relationship between imagination and physical possibility, what could be called the Roger Bannister effect. The second part concerns, and especially when discussing this younger generation of extreme athletes, all the other forces amplifying this relationship. We'll take them one at a time. If you want to understand the Bannister effect, says high-performance psychologist Michael Gervais, you have to understand that the brain tells stories. When most hear about an impossible feat, the sub-4-minute mile, the mega ramp 1080, our first reaction is, not real, no way, not possible. But we have a strong need to make meaning out of experience, and this new reality forces us to change our story. We move to, that's crazy, far out, unreal. Pretty soon we accept this new reality and shift our paradigm further, and this engages imagination. We start imagining the impossible as possible. What does impossible feel like, sound like, look like? And then we start to be able to see ourselves doing the impossible. That's the secret. There is an extremely tight link between our visual system and our physiology. Once we can actually see ourselves doing the impossible, our chances of pulling it off increase significantly. It was Harvard physiologist Edmund Jacobson who first discovered this link. Back in the 1930s, Jacobson found that imagining oneself lifting an object triggered corresponding electrical activity in the muscles involved in the lift. Between then and now, dozens and dozens of studies have borne this out, repeatedly finding strong correlations between mental rehearsal, that is, visualization, and better performance. Everything from giving a speech to running a business meeting to spinning a 1080 are all significantly enhanced by the practice. We also know that the benefits extend beyond the psychological, increased confidence and motivation, and into the physiological. In 2004, for example, Cleveland Clinic physiologist Guang Yue wanted to know if merely thinking about lifting weights was enough to increase strength. Study subjects were divided into 4 groups. One group tried to strengthen their finger muscles with physical exercise. One tried to strengthen their finger muscles by only visualizing the exercise. Another tried to increase arm strength through visualization, while the last group did nothing at all. The trial lasted 12 weeks. When it was over, those who did nothing saw no gains. The group that relied on physical training saw the greatest increase in strength, at 53%. But it's the mental groups where things got curious. Folks who did no physical training, but merely imagined their fingers going through precise exercise motions, saw a 35% increase in strength, while the ones who visualized arm exercises saw a 13.5% increase in strength. How tightly are imagination and physiology coupled? Strength is among the most baseline of all performance measures, and we humans can get stronger simply by thinking hard about it. Probably the biggest insight arrived a few years before UA's experiment, when neuroscientists found no difference between performing an action and merely imagining oneself performing that action. The same neuronal circuits fire in either case. This means that visualization impacts a slew of cognitive processes: motor control, memory, attention, perception, planning, essentially accelerating chunking by shortening the time it takes us to learn new patterns. Since the first stage of the flow cycle, the struggle stage, involves exactly this learning process, visualization is an essential flow hack. It shortens struggle. Visualization also firms up aims and objectives, further amplifying flow. With an image of perfect performance fixed in our mind, the intrinsic system knows what needs to happen, keeping the extrinsic system from getting too involved. Similarly, when attempting something that's never been done before, we're much more likely to keep fear at bay and stay in the challenge skill sweet spot if we've mentally rehearsed an action ahead of time. What all this means is that learning the impossible is possible augments our ability to see ourselves doing the impossible, which triggers a systemic change in the body and the brain, which closes the gap between fantasy and reality. It also makes us significantly more flow-prone. So when we do actually execute on our vision, that is, attempt the impossible, we're far more likely to find ourselves in the zone during that attempt, and far more likely to perform properly as a result. So what does this have to do with today's extreme athletes? Plenty. Not only have the children of this revolution been born into a world where the foundational, imaginal work has already been done. Tom Schar didn't have to dream up the mega ramp before he threw that 1080. They've also benefited from the arrival of psychology and technology in action and adventure sports. When I was starting out, says freestyle motocross great Travis Pastrana, there were no coaches, no real training facilities. There was barely a sport. Tom Schar, meanwhile, has coaches. He has trampoline rooms and foam pits and all sorts of high-tech equipment to train his body and his mind. Schar's been practicing visualization since the age of 10 and had a working knowledge of flow at 12. And when it comes to applying this information in our lives, especially if we're interested in the kinds of accelerated performance showing up in action and adventure sports, there appears to be considerable benefit to starting young. When you're talking about this next generation of athletes, says high-performance expert Dr. Leslie Sherlin, who we met back in Chapter 2, their lack of age helps a great deal. They're too young to know what impossible means. Can you do something? Who knows? Let me go try. And they're too young to know what to be afraid of. Schar, for example, has never had a serious injury. Plus, their brains aren't completely developed, so there's less frontal lobe engagement. Long-term planning, critical thinking, a lot of these things aren't fully online. As we learned earlier, one of the causes of flow is transient hypofrontality, the shutting down of large swatches of the prefrontal cortex. Children, as Sherlin pointed out, are developmentally hypofrontal, meaning portions of their neocortex are not fully formed. The brain keeps developing until age 25, and this makes them even more flow-prone. More than that, he continues, EEG studies of adolescents show their normal brainwave pattern is much closer to the alpha-wave-theta-wave borderline that is baseline flow. No direct research has been done, but it looks like they're hovering on the edge of the state much of the time. Putting flow-prone kids into high-flow environments means a lot of flow. Arming them with advanced flow-hacking techniques means even more. All this flow makes the activity deeply rewarding, both fulfilling a child's innate need for autonomy, mastery, and purpose, and further increasing their sense of intrinsic motivation. When Tom Shar says, "I love being with my friends at the skate park, that's the greatest feeling," what he's saying is no one has to force him to practice. The autotelic nature of the activity, the fact that it drives him into flow, is the source code of his motivation. But it's not just Tom Shar. In fact, when it comes to examples of the accelerated progression that results from raising children in high-flow environments, we can look much closer to home. In the classrooms, gardens, and playgrounds of Montessori schools the world over. While exploring the threads of his seminal research on flow, Mihai Csikszentmihalyi and his graduate students went on a quest to find the most flow-prone learning environments around. Montessori topped the list. The educational philosophy pioneered by Maria Montessori in the early portion of the 20th century is built around self-directed learning, long periods of intense concentration, and deep physicality. It's often called embodied education, and has been repeatedly shown to produce far greater amounts of flow than more traditional methodologies. The results? While the data is still far from complete, a 2006 study published in the journal Science by University of Virginia psychologist Angeline Lillard found Montessori kids outperformed regular students on everything from academic tests to social skills to creative abilities to executive function. Other studies have extended these findings from the classroom to the boardroom. When professors Jeffrey Dyer of Brigham Young University and Hal Gregerson of the globe-spanning business school INSEAD surveyed over 3,000 executives and interviewed 500 people who had either started innovative companies or invented new products, they too found a Montessori connection. As Gregerson told the Wall Street Journal, "A number of the innovative entrepreneurs also went to Montessori schools, where they learned to follow their curiosity." To paraphrase the famous Apple ad campaign, innovators not only learned early on to think different, they act different, and even talk different. So if we take this next generation of action and adventure athletes as our test case, you've got to wonder, if Tom Shar, raised in a high-flow environment, was able to best Tony Hawk by the age of 12, what flow-hacking, Montessori-educated kid is now taking aim at Larry Page and Sergey Brin's achievements? And what are the very real possibilities for the rest of us? What happens when the source code of ultimate human performance becomes a cornerstone of education? When flow becomes central to culture? When achieving the impossible becomes par for the course? Hard to say for certain. But as Rainer Maria Rilke said, "Live the questions." And seriously, knowing what we already know about flow, who doesn't want to live these questions? Flow hacking technologies. One idea central to this book is the ever-familiar knowledge is power. If flow underpins optimal performance, then knowing the causes of flow, both where it comes from and why it comes, can help us achieve optimal performance more frequently. If we go one level deeper into this relationship, we'll get to the lineage of technology that supports this knowing. Thus, if we want to understand what's possible for the next generation of athletes, or, for that matter, for anyone interested in harnessing this state to improve performance, we also need to understand the revolution that technology is now bringing to flow research. Go back to Roger Bannister's time, and the most sophisticated equipment we had was a stopwatch, says Michael Gervais. Knowing how long it takes someone to do something is useful, but it's still a gross metric that explains little about the why. The stopwatch told us Bannister ran a sub-4 mile, yet we learned nothing about how he did it or how we could do it. But between then and now, there have been 6 or 7 measurement milestones. We moved from gross physical measures to more precise biodata, from invasive biodata procedures to non-invasive procedures. Until you get to where we are today, able to measure and quantify ATP, adenosine triphosphate, essentially cellular energy, levels in real time. This means that our ability to stalk elite performance has undergone a sea change, as has our ability to stalk flow. In the 1990s, magnetic resonance imaging, MRI, which had been primarily used to study the body, gave way to functional magnetic resonance imaging, fMRI, which measures blood flow activity in the brain. At Johns Hopkins, it was this technique that allowed Charles Lim to scan the brains of improv jazz musicians during flow, providing our first images of transient hypofrontality in action. At Emory, it was fMRI that helped Greg Burns map the dopamine system's relationship to flow triggers like risk and novelty. At Baylor, it was David Eagleman and time dilation. And this list goes on. Neural feedback, the use of EEG to train performance, has undergone a similar transformation. Dr. Leslie Sherlin and his colleagues at Neurotopia, to offer one example, have developed an EEG-based system called BrainSport that, unlike earlier EEG systems, uses advanced hardware and sophisticated software to filter out extraneous noise. As of now, it can record the neuroelectrical activity of a golfer making a putt, a ball player swinging a bat, or a speaker giving a talk. Devices capable of working in action and adventure sports environments are only a year or two away. Travis Pastrana is putting an early iteration through its paces. Even better, BrainSport is portable and simple to use. The idea was to develop a robust neural feedback system that works for everyone, says Sherlin. People no longer have to come to the lab, get tons of sensors attached, and destroy their normal routines. A football player on the flight home after a game, a businessman about to enter a meeting, a housewife with a half hour before the kids come home. They just put on the headset and start training. Concurrently, a revolution in sensors, batteries, and connectivity has led to a flood of quantified self devices such as Nike Fuel Band, Jawbones Up, and the Basis Band. These wearable gadgets monitor an expansive array of biometrics, most of which can be used to hunt flow. And there are iPhone apps that do the same. We can now track cardiac coherence when brain waves and heart waves sync up, which has been correlated with the state, but needs more research. Other apps let skiers and snowboarders calculate speed, helping them both dial in their challenge skill ratio and pin down the exact miles per hour that trips their novelty and risk flow triggers. At the Flow Genome Project, we're taking advantage of both of these lines of development to build a series of dedicated flow research labs, a.k.a. flow dojos. Think Cirque du Soleil meets X Games meets the Science Exploratorium. The goal is to simulate all of the high-risk conditions that extreme performers rely upon to trigger flow, just without the risk. Our equipment is of the extreme playground variety, like a giant looping swing that lets almost anyone be safely upside down and 25 feet off the ground at the top of the loop, and pulling over 3.5 G's at the bottom, which is enough risk and novelty to push most into flow. Moreover, the swing is lined with LED lights that are connected to sensors like BrainSport. The closer a rider comes to the theta-alpha brainwave border of baseline flow, the redder the lights turn. This allows the trainee to use real-time neurofeedback without having to break state to look at a data screen. Of course, with all these sensors, we're also data capturing along the way and using this information to construct a more accurate heat map of flow, a map that will fine-tune our knowledge of the state and its triggers and thus provide everyone with easier access to the zone. And ours is only one approach. There are many more, and from dozens of angles. But that's not even the half of it. Alongside these technological developments increasing our in-the-moment access to flow, there's also an entirely different line of development increasing the total amount of time we can stay in the flow hacking game. Welcome to the world of bionics. Hugh Herr, the head of the biomechatronics research group at MIT's Media Lab, is at the forefront of this world. He's already built the Rio Knee and the iWalk Biome Ankle, the world's first two artificially intelligent prosthetics. Both of these devices mimic natural movement patterns, are capable of learning, so they adjust to the user's gait and not the other way around. And were named Inventions of the Year by Time Magazine, the Rio in 2004, the Biome in 2007. How durable and dynamic are these devices? The Biome, the more sophisticated of the two, is already being worn by amputee soldiers returning to active duty. But prosthetics for amputee soldiers are just the beginning. Herr has also designed the world's first true bionic exoskeleton, a revolutionary knee brace for able-bodied people that should be commercially available by 2015. Right now, Herr says, one of the worst parts of growing old is losing the ability to move around. So imagine taking the bionics in the Biome and turning it into a strap-on device, something that can restore strength and function to the elderly or anyone with a bum knee. Most of the athletes interviewed for this book didn't start exploring flow until their late 20s or early 30s, and none feel they have come close to utilizing the state's full potential. Unfortunately, as flow explorer skills improve over time, our physical abilities head in the opposite direction. But not for long. Herr's bionic knee brace can extend all of our athletic careers for years, possibly decades. And it's only the first in a torrent of biological enhancement possibilities now in the pipeline. The standard metric for describing exponential growth rates in technology is Moore's Law, the fact that the number of transistors on an integrated circuit doubles every 12 to 24 months, while the price remains the same. Moore's Law is the reason why today's smartphones are 1,000 times faster and 1,000,000 times cheaper than a supercomputer from the 1970s. Meanwhile, biotechnology, the category that underpins exoskeletons and other enhancement technologies, is currently accelerating at 5 times the speed of Moore's Law. What is the adjacent possible for strap-on bionics? What promise do exoskeletons hold for the future of progression? What about flow hacking? Until recently, older and wiser meant creakier and slower. But with biotechnology expanding at an exponential rate, we can now refresh the physical line of development, while our cognitive and creative lines continue to grow. For the first time in history, anyone looking to push the upper edge of human performance will be able to combine the wisdom of the decades with the sprightliness of youth. So again, where do our limits lie? I'm certain we can't answer that question, says Michael Gervais. At the world-class level, where talent differences are marginal, we estimate that 90% of success for elite performers is mental. Yet this is the one measurement milestone we haven't hit. We don't know how to measure thought. What is it? Where does it begin? Where does it go? Can we track it? Can we track its effects? What's an accurate picture of its total impact on biology? Until we know these things, psychology remains a fuzzy science. But that's what's next. That's where this technological revolution is leading. That's why predicting limits is so difficult, because we're about to be able to take control of the one aspect of performance that trumps all others. Alex Honnold and Halfdome. If we do want to take a stab at predicting future limits, one place to turn is the sport of rock climbing. While most of action and adventure sports didn't become extreme until the early 1990s, And skateboarding, our earlier example, not until 2002, when Danny Way introduced the mega ramp. Rock climbers began free soloing, no ropes, you fall, you die, in the 1970s. This means that their knowledge base and baseline for reality got tipped toward impossible a little ahead of the general action and adventure sports curve. In other words, meet Alex Honnold. Alex Honnold started climbing at indoor gyms in 1996, when he was 11 years old. At 19, Honnold moved outdoors, where he soon developed a preference for big walls. Free soloing came next. In 2007, this 22-year-old self-described dork and total climbing unknown free soloed Yosemite's Astro Man and the Rostrum in a day. A feat so difficult it's only been done twice before, and both times by legendary hard men, Peter Croft and Dean Potter. The following year, Honnold started thinking about free soloing the northwest face of Yosemite's Half Dome. It was a notion beyond the beyond. When you talk about what the next generation of athletes considers possible, says Jimmy Chin, who has climbed with Honnold and directed a documentary on him for National Geographic, Alex is the case study. His imaginative capabilities are just so far beyond everyone else in the sport. Back when he started thinking about Half Dome, no one else I knew, and I probably know most of the elite climbing community, was even considering a solo. And for good reason. Astro Man and the Rostrum are medium-sized climbs, both in the intermediate 5'11 range. Half Dome is a big wall, a 2,000-foot face that most teams take multiple days to complete, and the route Alex had in mind went expert only, 5'12C. Worse, the route gets harder as it goes higher. Chin explains further. The route Alex chose wasn't impossible for him. He could do the moves. But it's such an exhausting mental game. And with the hardest moves near the top, it's the equivalent of an NBA basketball player, under last game of the finals pressure, having to execute 1,000 free throws, step back to the three-point line, and shoot 100 three-pointers. And then, after all that physical and mental exhaustion, step back and shoot one half-court shot. And this isn't about winning. All the shots have to go in, because any miss is fatal. A week before Honnold decided to solo Half Dome, he climbed his desired route with a friend, and a rope, to dial in the moves. Normally, before attempting a hard solo, he would make repeat practice climbs. But a Half Dome lap took an entire day to complete. Honestly, Honnold says, I didn't want to have to explain to anyone why I was spending so much time on that route. On September 6th, 2008, after a day spent sitting in his van and visualizing the climb, Honnold hiked to the base of Half Dome, set fingers to stone, and pulled upward. He kept pulling. Up a zesty finger crack, then a few easier pitches, then one of the route's trickier sections. A nasty boulder problem above a small ledge. The ledge offers security, but the link-up requires 6 hard moves some 500 feet off the deck. I don't remember much of the climb, says Honnold, but I remember that corner. I almost flipped off the wall. That got my attention. It also drove him deeper into the zone. Over the next few pitches, he used the state to establish an easy rhythm, trying to conserve his strength. He'd need it. Up ahead was a blank stretch of rock normally bypassed by an aid-climbing bolt ladder. Last time through, Honnold had done a 5'12C variation to avoid the bolts. But the holds were razor thin, and this time, without a rope, he didn't like those odds. Rumor told of a rarely used route circumnavigating the entire blank stretch. I didn't know anything about it, says Honnold, but I started wandering around, trying to not get lost. There was no sign that anybody had ever come this way. The holds were dirty. I was clawing through bushes. This was dead center Half Dome, and I was probably off route. Arnold wasn't off route, but it still took a 100-foot down climb of a finger-wide crack to get him back to his line. Luckily, the next 500 feet were a comforting chimney system. Stem feet, palm wall, repeat. Finally, a small ledge. 2 hours in, over 1,000 feet up, Arnold took off his shoes to relax. Then he put them back on. It was time to head up the zigzags. Last time through, this corner crack system had caused some trouble. This time, not so much. I climbed almost as if in a daze, Arnold later explained in an article for Climbing. I knew what to do. I just tried not to think about it too much. I didn't think about the hard pitches above. I didn't think about the 511-plus slab on top, a pitch above the zigzags. I just moved steadily between small finger locks up the steep dihedral. The crux of the first zigzag felt much easier than it had 2 days before, probably because now I had a sequence. Every hold felt crisp and perfect, and I pulled really hard. He pulled up the rest of the zigzags and onto the aptly named Thank God ledge. This fabled feature is 35 feet long, starting out plenty wide, but then the rock bulges and the path narrows. And, being 1,800 feet in the air, most people get on their knees and crawl. Arnold walked. The ledge ends in a short chimney that guards the final slab. The slab is freaky hard. From his last trip, Arnold remembered 2 critical moves. But he was in the zone and sailed through the first move, then out of it completely, grinding to an absolute halt before the second. I just came apart. I froze. What the hell am I doing here, thoughts? A full-scale panic attack. It was really scary and really surreal. The move is barely 200 feet from the summit. There's always a crowd on top of Half Dome. You can hike up the other side. I could hear people talking and laughing. I was really glad they couldn't see me. Worse, temptation was close at hand. For less ambitious climbers, a bolt ladder runs through this section as well. An enormous oval carabiner hung inches away. If Arnold snatched it, the solo would be tainted. If he didn't, he could die. I stroked the beaner a few times, fighting the urge to grab it, but also thinking how foolish it would be to die on a slab, sliding 2,000 feet to my death when I could so easily save myself. My calves were slowly getting pumped. I knew I should do something soon, since treading water was only wearing me out. Down climbing never occurred to me. I was going up. It was just a matter of how high, one way or another. Sometimes the distance through impossible is nothing at all. Arnold smeared his toe on the rock, weighed the leg, then stood up. Done deal. He took the final 5-7 section at a near run. There were some 24 hikers on top, but few paid him much mind. Couples made out. Families ate lunch. Tourists snapped photos. Arnold had just become the first person in history to solo Half Dome, but it was only on the way down that he got any credit. As he'd left his hiking boots at the base of the climb, Arnold had to hike down barefoot. All these people kept coming up to me and asking where my shoes were, he says. I had just spent 3 hours doing a huge solo, and guys were, "Dude, you're barefoot! That's hardcore!" Uh-huh. Yep. Hardcore. To put Arnold's accomplishment in different terms, when talking about Tom Schaar and his Mega Ramp 1080, most feel his youth is more astounding than the leap forward in progression. The general reaction is, sure, that's amazing, but just imagine what Schaar's going to be able to do when he's 20. Alex Arnold is the answer to that question. He's climbing's version of Tom Schaar, only all grown up. He was born into a world where both his baseline for reality and his spectrum for possibility were a quantum leap forward from the previous generation, and he took full advantage. Isaac Newton wasn't wrong. We all see farther by standing on the shoulders of giants. In other words, asking what the future would hold if flow became central to culture is another way of asking how good the view is from Honnold's shoulders. Again, it's hard to say for certain, but it's worth pointing out that in 2000